Call the task committee meeting to order. Members, today we're going to have a couple of bills on the agenda and also a presentation from the Minnesota Association of Realtors. So start with the chair will move House File 1516 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I have a couple of amendments to get the bill in the shape that I'd like, if I can offer them, please.
That's
the, A1 amendment simply corrects a drafting error on indexing in the original bill. And I don't know if you need a...
The chair moves the A1 amendment. All those, any discussion to the A1 amendment, putting the bill in the order in which the author would like? If not, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, the amendment is adopted.
And then, Mr. Chair, the DE2 amendment just reflects the changes that I have made from the Senate companion, and I'll explain that in more detail later.
Okay. The, can you give us just a brief idea of what it does, Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, the Senate version of the bill had different rate changes than this proposal, and so this just puts it as the direction that I would like to take it.
Okay. The chair will move the DE2 amendment, again putting the bill in the form in which the author would like. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who are opposed, the amendment is adopted. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thanks for hearing my bill. Let me just start by saying that despite the debate and the vote on the budget resolution that we had yesterday, we can still offer another budget resolution. I think it's time to honestly start talking about taxes. In 1999 and 2000, we had a booming economy. We had surplus after surplus. There was talk of boatloads of money. And the proposed income tax cuts seemed logical at the time. I voted for those income tax cuts, and I was wrong. I believed naively that if the economy soured, that this legislature and the governor would do the right thing and join together in a bipartisan manner and fix the problem. We didn't do that, but we should have, and we still can. House File 1516 rolls back a portion of those income tax cuts. Most members of this body know that we need more revenue, but Republicans and Democrats don't want to use the T word, but we should. 57% of the electorate believes that we should resolve our ongoing budget problems with some cuts, but also with tax increases. Now, the governor is fond of accusing those of us who are critical of his budget cuts as proclaiming that the sky is falling. Well, I don't think the sky is falling, but the cuts to services and our failure to invest in our state has an incremental effect, and we are seeing signs of a diminished quality of life. We used to rank number one or in the top five or in the top ten in many quality of life categories, and we still do, but we're slipping in the middle of the pack in many areas. Now, I know some in this legislature want us to be more like our neighbors. This is the way cuts and caps have been rationalized. We say that Wisconsin only appropriates X amount of money to human services, or South Dakota only does X amount for education. But there's a reason why Minnesota, even with relatively higher taxes, and that is often questionable, has the strongest economy in the Midwest, and why people continue to move here, because we've invested. We've invested in early childhood education. We've invested in K-12 education. We've invested in higher education, in health care, in job training, in economic development. We pride ourselves on a clean environment. We've invested in transportation. So is the sky falling? Well, I can tell you in my district, our ECFB just closed because of budget cuts. My school district is facing another huge deficit, $20 million. Whopping property tax increases because the state is shifting the burden to counties, cities, and school districts. 32,000 low-income adults losing their health insurance, many who will wind up at hospitals like Regions and HCMC as charity cases, uncompensated care that will be picked up by property taxpayers or increases in health premiums. Our college students are seeing double-digit tuition increases year after year. We're seeing a dismantling of public transportation as gridlock gets worse. Families with disabled kids are paying more in fees or having services cuts. We can go on and on and on. We have 2 months, members, left in this legislative session. We can craft a new budget resolution. I think that we need to debate the budget and taxes honestly. I was born and raised in this great state, and it pains me to watch this legislature balance the budget on the backs of the poor and the vulnerable. It pains me that we can't find a way to compromise and do the right thing for Minnesota. We can do today, or in the coming weeks, decide what is the most progressive way of restoring some of the most hurtful cuts made during the last biennium, deal with the current deficit, maintain a healthy reserve, and invest in our children's future by blinking off part of the income tax cuts made in 1999 and 2000. Now, members, you have a chart in front of you that shows the what we're proposing to do here is, I wouldn't say it's a pure rollback. You have the comparisons. One is set in Senator Hottinger's bill, and you can see the rate changes in his bill. And my proposal is to bring the rates to roll back to 8.5% on the high bracket, 7.62 in the middle bracket, 5.7 on the lower bracket. And this proposal would raise $1 billion in revenue over the biennium. And if you look at this proposal, I have to say that Nina Manzi was really helpful to me in putting this all together. And if you have specific questions about the chart, you can ask her. And at the end of our presentations, Mr. Chair, I'll have Nan Mazden up here to answer some budget questions. But you will see, if you look at the chart, that if someone was making in tax year 1999 and in the proposal today, the amount, even with the rollback, they'd be paying less in state income taxes than they were in 1999. So I think this would be relatively painless, and we can do some good things for the state of Minnesota. So what I'd like to do, with your permission, Mr. Chair, is allow my witnesses to make some very, very brief comments. And my first witness is the Most Reverend Victor Bakke. He's the Bishop of Crookston, Minnesota Catholics Conference, if that would be appropriate at this time.
Thank you, Representative Thamar, and Reverend Black. Welcome to the committee. If you just, again, for the record, give us your name and your position, and if you represent any organizations.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Bishop Victor Bakke of the Diocese of Crookston, and I am a member of the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, which is the statewide public policy organization of the Roman Catholic bishops from each of the 6 dioceses in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for providing me with an opportunity to share our perspective on this matter with you this morning. My fellow bishops and I support the bill that is before you today for consideration, House File 1516, which seeks to partially roll back some of the state income tax cuts enacted between 1999 and 2001. Because, as we said in our recent statement, which I notice has been distributed, sharing our blessings and our burdens, as pastors, teachers, and bishops, we do not believe that we can use the solution of 2 years ago to address our current situation without doing further harm to the values of the gospel and to the principles of our Catholic social teaching. We further believe that it is time to chart a new direction, and in our opinion, this bill does just that. You will hear testimony today about the economic implications of this proposal, and you will also hear statistical data about the human consequences of the budget cuts made during the 2003 legislative session. It is one thing to hear statistical reports about how budget cuts have impacted our neighbors. It is quite another thing to see the real faces of real people who are suffering. We, bishops, see those faces in our communities throughout our state. And about 2 weeks ago, the bishops of the state met with certain people who have been really hurt by these cuts. And we met with some of the providers, and the stories they told us were truly heartrending. As Archbishop Harry Flynn recently stated, caps and cuts can be cruel words when they mean adding to the suffering of our children, our elderly, our disabled, our sick, our newcomers to this country, and those housed in shelters or on our streets. For these reasons, as Archbishop Harry Flynn further advised, our state's budget is more than just a document. It is a moral statement. Although we do much as a church and as individuals to meet the many needs of our poor and vulnerable brothers and sisters through our many charitable organizations, we must partner with our government to do together what we cannot accomplish on our own. As we explained in our recent statement, in Catholic teaching, paying taxes flows from the virtues of justice and love, because taxes are one of the means by which we share our blessings with and build up the common good. The just collection and distribution of tax revenues are important functions of government, for government is a means to do together what we cannot accomplish on our own. Among other things, taxes allow us to build roads and develop public transit systems, educate our children, protect our families and homes, invest in economic and agricultural development, safeguard our environment, and, most importantly, care for our brothers and sisters in need. We believe that paying just and equitable taxes for the sake of the common good is our Christian duty, because it is the way in which we who are haves share our blessings with our brothers and sisters who are have-nots. Guided by our values and principles, and after examining the realities of our state's economy, its budgetary needs and revenue resources, my fellow bishops and I agree that because human needs require it, and other resources are not available to meet these needs, it is right and proper to raise income taxes justly and equitably based upon each individual's ability to pay. We are not alone in supporting an increase in income taxes as part of a balanced solution to resolving our current budget deficit and mitigating some of the harm caused by the budget cuts made in 2003. As reported in the Minneapolis Star Tribune on February 5, 2005, in a recent poll, and I quote, 36% of all Minnesotans say they have been hurt by recent state budget cuts. Women and middle-aged Minnesotans were more likely than others to say cuts had hurt them. End of quote. In that same poll, and I quote again, 57% said the legislature and Governor Tim Pawlenty should rely on both tax increases and spending cuts to resolve the budget crisis. And, still quoting, among those earning $75,000 or more, 66% favored a combination of tax increases, user fees, and budget cuts. As we advised in the conclusion of our recent statement, We as bishops place our hope and confidence in the people of Minnesota, who have always shown great love and compassion for people in need. We know they are willing to sacrifice for their poor brothers and sisters facing financial hardships. The taxes we pay today, and those paid by our parents and grandparents before us, have allowed us, as Minnesotans, to develop and sustain a high quality of life in our state. But more importantly, the taxes we pay allow us to meet our moral responsibility toward our fellow citizens, our brothers and sisters in the family of God, who need our help to live a life in accord with their God-given dignity. On behalf of the Catholic Bishops of Minnesota, I thank you for your consideration and for your hard work on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Reverend Balke. Let's continue then. Representative Paymer, you have other witnesses?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Rabbi Sim Glazer.
Excuse me, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to speak before Bishop Balke left. And Bishop Balke, I appreciate your testimony, and thank you so much for being here. It's an honor. I have to tell members that Bishop Balke is my bishop, and in fact confirmed my daughter last year at St. Elizabeth Church. And I have to say, Representative Paymer, you talk about putting the pressure on. And yesterday, Representative Knobloch was talking about postcards coming out on the budget resolution, but Bishop Balke has much more important connections than any political caucus in putting pressure on and so forth. But Bishop Balke, thank you so much for being here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Rabbi Sim Glazer of Temple Israel in Minneapolis, Associate Rabbi, member of Jewish Community Action. My father, of blessed memory, also a rabbi, counseled me never to follow eloquent bishops. Nevertheless, that's where you put me, so I'm going to do my best. Temple Israel is located not far from the urban center, not very far at all from a number of neighborhoods, a number of homes, homeowners, a number of schools that are struggling to stay afloat. Now, we do what we can at Temple. Our caring community regularly grapples with the question of how we can contribute to our city. We've remained in the urban center because we don't want to flee and go out into the suburbs. It's not our thing. We believe that we have to be good neighbors and do what we can. And thus we find ourselves busily assisting at soup kitchens, trying to raise money to build affordable homes through Habitat or other means, mentoring children one at a time at the school across the street. But as we do these things, we know in our hearts that they are little more than band-aid approaches to far more significant issues that confront our state. I think most of the good-hearted people of Minnesota know that their acts of immediate volunteer service and their modest donations to the greater community are good and they're well-meaning, but they're not unlike trying to fish drowning babies out of a flowing river one at a time with a net that has a lot of holes in it. You miss so many of those kids, so many of the people in need. A far better plan, as the story goes, is to run up the side of the river, run up the riverbank, and determine who's throwing the children in. Certainly there are many variables that contribute to the sad state of affairs of the poor in our community. But when a state faces its financial intentions and figures out what it needs to do, it is no time to balance the budget on the backs of the most vulnerable among us, as the bishop so beautifully put it a few moments ago. The moment we start doing that, we become witnesses, as the bishop also said, to how the budget becomes a moral document, or in the case of cutting taxes, and by extension, deeply needed services, it becomes an immoral document that we represent, that we're putting forth. And that's not right. The Jewish people are approaching Passover. If there are Jewish people in the room, you know it's time to start cleaning the house and getting rid of the bread and all that stuff. And on that holiday, We as Jews are bidden to let all who are hungry come and eat. At that holiday, we are admonished to remember the widow, the orphan and the stranger, and the homeless among us. For as Scripture reminds us, we too were strangers in the land of Egypt. That means that we all have that in our past. Sadly, it strikes me that perhaps those who don't feel the obligation to increase or to maintain tax levels to ensure security and to provide for the most basic needs of all our citizens may have forgotten that the welfare of your own forebears, your ancestors, almost certainly was seen to at some point in time by this great nation. We can do no less for those who are impacted now. And on this holiday of Passover, we tell of the most famous baby ever to be thrown into a river and then fished out. And that baby was Moses himself, who brought the fundamental teachings of morality to the Western world. Moses' name comes from the Hebrew word, mashah, to draw out of the water. That's where the name comes from, a baby to be saved and cared for. Moses went on to lead his nation through parted waters to a glorious future of self-determination. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of Moseses around anymore. He's not available to us anymore. It's our turn to part waters. It's our turn to allow Minnesotans to flourish with dignity, giving them every opportunity we can provide. Who knows what kind of future leaders we have in the children we're neglecting right now. Every child in Minnesota represents the future of this amazing state. Let's not cast them into rivers of poverty, into rivers of limited education, into rivers of homelessness, second-class health care. Let's invest in our community by tithing with the generosity that our common faith heritages command us. Very few of us tithe the way the Bible told us to. The taxes help us do that. If we do not do this, we will pay for it dearly later. We will never fish all the children out, or their children after them, or their children after them. Please make an about face. Support the bill to roll back state income tax cuts. It is our duty to invest in Minnesota's future. I know it's never been popular to raise taxes. It's never been popular to do the right thing. Any prophet of Israel will tell you that if you read the Bible. Thank you for your attention.
And then, Mr. Chair, we have Charles Kite, the Minnesota Association School Administrators.
Representative Krinke and members of the committee, good morning. I am Charlie Kite, and as I just stated, I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and our association represents all the school superintendents in the state of Minnesota. My testimony, first of all, is going to pale after listening to both the bishop and our rabbi. In fact, I was just thinking, if you all are already all convinced, I could actually spare you my testimony. I think maybe there's one or two left.
We might need a little more.
A little more. Okay. First of all, our association, the school superintendents of the state, support House File 1516. Now, I'd like to begin by saying how much school leaders appreciate the increased revenue that has been already proposed for K-12 education. If you add up the parts and pieces, it comes to about 2.5% a year, or about $150 per pupil in revenue. And this is a good beginning, but the need is still greater. And we're here to discuss that briefly. I think the fact that public education is already being proposed to get some increase in funding is a recognition of the stresses on our public education system. And those stresses are real and they're political. We also recognize and feel badly about the fact that public education is seeing a large portion of the new revenue that's available be dedicated toward public education. While we're still saying it is not enough money, we also recognize that puts stress on all the other parts of the system that needs funding as well. We have asserted over the last 3 or 4 months that public education needs about a 5% increase. That's about $250 per student each year of this biennium in order for the cuts to stop and for us to recover from the short funding of 2 years ago and to cover our needs going forward. If that would happen, if $250 per student was allocated to public education for each year of the biennium, I could tell you that the cutbacks in programs and the layoffs of teachers would end in 95 to 98% of the schools and school districts statewide. The issue here, though, is that the entire state system, not only education, needs more revenue. The citizens of this state depend on a variety of public programs and services, and when the resources are significantly cut in all other areas, there's a serious ripple effect that we see in the schools and causes the learning of students to be more challenging and the well-being of our students to be more challenging. MASA, our association, about 3 weeks ago actually called for a full rollback of the 1999-2000 tax reductions. And we recognize that this bill is not a full rollback, but a partial rollback. But we feel that this bill would go a long way towards helping to fund the needs here in the state. So we ask you to find the revenue necessary to spare our excellent system of public K-12 schools, and also to find the dollars necessary to fund the other programs that are so important to the well-being of the citizens of this state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cade.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Koppel, members of the committee. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund, a nonprofit advocacy organization advocating for children in Minnesota. Children's Defense Fund is a private nonprofit that accepts no public money, funded through foundations and other contributions. I would like to talk about two big impacts that the cuts have had in recent years, and also to reiterate what previous witnesses have said in support of this legislation to raise revenue. The two areas I want to talk about are what are two of the key areas to children's success, and especially our youngest children, and also to successful families, and that is early childhood support such as child care and health care. It's the two reasons why parents miss work. It's the two reasons most likely why parents go back on welfare. And it is the reason that more children, especially at-risk children, are not ready for kindergarten, are not treated early, are not for their health care needs, and are low rates of vaccinations. In the last cuts in 2003, as a result, over 10,000 children have dropped off the subsidized child care rolls. It isn't because we cut back dramatically and took over $80 million out of child care in support of these families with children. It isn't because we are now have the 32nd lowest eligibility rates for child care and we used to be fourth. It's because these 10,000 children are actually still eligible for the program, but they can no longer afford the co-pays, and because of the freeze to the provider rates, they can no longer afford the additional costs that the providers pass on to them because the reimbursements don't meet their costs. Therefore, 10,000 children no longer receive subsidized child care in Minnesota. These are both families on welfare, on TANF, our MPIP program, and families on the sliding fee program, about 50-50. But the point is that they no longer are on those rolls, and they are still eligible, but no longer can afford the very program that was designed for them. As a result of the freeze, we anticipate to continue $70 million cut to provider rates in Minnesota. The department estimates that between our welfare families and our sliding fee families, that on average, another 1,200 families per month, fewer children, 1,200 fewer children per month will be receiving child care. These same families in 2003 were also included in the health care cuts. In the health care cuts, 20,000 children lost health care coverage. In the most recent statistics put out by the health department, we now have 77,000 more uninsured Minnesotans than we did in 2001. That's the first time that trend has gone to a higher number in over 15 years. We have fewer children as a result covered by health care coverage than we did 3 years ago. We have fewer children in quality child care. We have fewer at-risk children in high-quality child care that has proven to get them ready to learn and be successful when they start kindergarten. We're cutting the budget, and we're hurting working families. The same families that lost health care lost their child care in 2003 are the ones that were most likely to lose their health care because we're cutting back parents of children to 190% of poverty in Minnesota care. So now those parents that lost their eligibility for their children in child care are now losing their own health care coverage. The bottom line is that a child's first chance and best chance for success is their family. When families fail, we spend more money and we have worse outcomes. Whether it's in our child welfare system, incarceration, remedial education, dropout rates, or homelessness. By proposing continual cuts and not looking for resources to our child care system, resources for our health care system, to serve these children and their families, we're missing a great opportunity to ensure family success. We will all pay more later and we'll have less to show for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pepple.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brad Leto, the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and appreciate the opportunity to testify today. The Minnesota AFL-CIO would like to commend Representative Paymar for offering a real revenue solution without using gimmicks, shifts, and smoke and mirrors, which I think we've all been susceptible to the last number of years of the budget situations. The proposal doesn't use more fees, increase property taxes, and shifts to meet our budget needs. Bishop Balke talked about the real budget cuts that have caused real pain to real people. You probably heard that statement before, and I think the previous witnesses are much more eloquent than I in talking about it. Just to remind you of one of the bishop's quotes, because I think it is so very telling. He talked about having seen the real faces, quote unquote, the real faces of real people who are suffering. And I would imagine he sees them every day. Perhaps not all of you have seen these faces. I just want to say union members throughout Minnesota, and I'm talking about union members in the public sector, the private sector, and industrial unions, have seen these faces. And in many cases, are the families affected? Unions have members in public schools throughout Minnesota. Some union members and family members are on Minnesota Care and are now threatened with the loss of coverage by the governor's budget. Unions have members affected by increased property taxes, the loss of local government aid, and the cutbacks in local services ranging from public safety to the senior citizen centers. We would encourage you as lawmakers to seriously consider Representative Paymar's bill and real solutions to the state's ongoing budget problems. Be honest about revenue with Minnesotans. Minnesotans are smarter than they are sometimes given credit for, I think. And I think they can understand the difference between increased fees, increased property taxes, budget cutbacks that are affecting them daily, and an increased income tax. Thank you. I'd stand for any questions.
Mr. Chair, I realize that time is limited, but there's a few other people that came on the list late. Would that be okay if they just...
If we can be happy to have them, Representative Paymar, but just if we can keep the comments fairly brief, we'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Tax Committee, I'm Lee Greenfield from Hennepin County and the Hennepin County Medical Center, and also representing the Minnesota Hospital Association. What I want to point out is what's going on in the correlation between when we have to do, you have to cut back programs or cut payment rates and uncompensated care at hospitals, which I assure you one way or another has to get paid by somebody. And when the state created Minnesota Care in the early 90s, which was paid for, you all remember, by the health care access account funded by a 2% charge on all health care, the amount of money we provided hospitals from that account in the 90s led to a greater reduction in uncompensated care than we were spending. The reverse of that is now occurring as we cut back on programs. For hospitals in this state in the year 2000, there was about $223 million of uncompensated care. It started to slowly increase in the year 2001. 2002 was up to $238,000. It went up 10% between 2002 and 2003 to $258 million. Million dollars. Between 2003 and 2004, the effects of the cutbacks in eligibility in GAMC and Minnesota Care in particular led to a 28% increase in uncompensated care in our hospitals, where it's now up to $329 million per year. At the Hennepin County Medical Center, which has a very low rate of regularly insured people and a very high rate of people either that have no insurance or are insured by one of the programs from our state, uncompensated care went from, in the year 2000, $21 million a year, in the years 2001 and 2002, 2003, it was $23 to $24 million per year. From 2003 to 2004, it rose 38% to $31.4 million. At this point, Hennepin County adds in property tax about $19.6 million per year to keep the hospital functioning and out of debt. If the cuts that are in the governor's budget in this biennium were to be adopted, we would lose an additional $12 million a year. Uncompensated care in hospitals is paid for either through your health care premiums by transfer for hospitals that have significant amounts of insured workers or patients. Where they don't, and particularly in a safety net hospital like HCMC, very often it's local property taxes that pay it. One way or another, it's going to get paid. What we're doing is shifting costs down either to health care costs, if you all pay in your premiums, or to local property taxes. Happy to answer your question. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you today. I speak for the most vulnerable in our community, the disabled. And I want to thank the state of Minnesota for all the generous and constructive things that have gone on over the many years that I have been fighting for the disabled.
Excuse me, if you could give us your name, please.
My name is Bud Seltz.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And perhaps the reason I didn't give my name is because I was so concerned about the thousands of disabled that I'm speaking for that I lost my own identity in the process. But this is an ironic thing. I have never been in a position where I was fighting for an increase in taxes. But I can see where it's a wise investment for the state of Minnesota. When I think of the disability institution that serves my own son and has been in existence for 50 years, I can see where there is a tremendous lack of continuity in income for the people who serve at that facility, and it is being called to pull in all types of resources that they used to have, like therapy and such. I can see where years and years of investment are at risk unless a minimum of funding is returned to this facility. And thus I feel that it is the wisdom of the state to protect an investment that has accumulated over many years and help the most vulnerable in our midst. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Strelzer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Fuhr representing Education Minnesota. I'm pleased to be here to speak on behalf of this bill, House File 1516. Education Minnesota does represent 70,000 educators around the state, including higher education at our two-year colleges. And we believe that talking about resources is a necessary piece as we're talking about expenditures on the other side. We totally support this rollback. We think it's reasonable. It's an equitable and fair way of dealing with a tax increase. The state commitment to public education is set out in the Minnesota Constitution, and along with that, it says to make sure that we fund this through a system of taxation. So it makes sense. We always look at a balance of revenues. Obviously, income tax is a key one, sales tax, property tax. And once any of those gets out of whack, then I think we have some problems. And we're seeing some of that right now in many of our communities around the state. So this is a bill that, again, makes sense. We've heard testimony here about children and family support systems that are dwindling away because of lack of commitment by the state to help fund these. What we know in education is that students come in, if they come into school and have had some experience with ECFE and other family support systems, they come in better prepared to learn and are better able to be successful. It's those early years that really do make a difference in our student achievement and what occurs. I'll just end by saying we hope that you will support this. It makes sense. It does help us kind of get out of the hole that we've been in. We've had a lot of cuts in education, and ultimately when we get rid of teachers, those that suffer the most from that are the students. So please support this. Appreciate the time. Thank you.
And just to wrap up, Mr. Chair, and then we're done, is Nan Madden. She's the director of the Minnesota Budget Project. And then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues, with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. Since the state started facing budget deficits in the 2002 legislative session, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits has consistently argued for a balanced approach to the state's budget. We have called on decision makers to use all of the budget balancing tools available: judicious use of reserves and other one-time measures, reducing spending, and raising revenues. But in past legislative sessions, deficits have been addressed largely through one-time actions and spending cuts. There have been no broad-based revenue increases. But that does not mean that revenues have not been raised. They have been raised through a patchwork of increased fees, co-payments, and tuition. Significant cuts in local government aid and other sources of revenue to local governments have brought about both service cuts and property tax increases in our local communities. In 2003, there were those who argued that we should not ask Minnesotans to pay any more in state taxes. But many families would have been better off with a modest tax increase than with the budget choices that were made. To cite just a few examples, students looking to start their careers and incumbent workers seeking to gain new skills have faced double-digit tuition increases at our state colleges and universities at the same time that financial aid grants have been cut. Parents who receive services to enable them to care for disabled children at home have seen fee increases as much as several thousand dollars a year. Families working their way from welfare to self-sufficiency have lost $1,500 per year in cash assistance for each severely disabled family member present in their home. And families receiving child care assistance are now paying co-payments that are an average of 57% higher, or an additional $936 per year. There is a better way and a fairer way for the state to raise revenues. The state has already made considerable reduction in spending, and Minnesotans are feeling the impact of these cuts. And while nobody likes to pay taxes, we tend to like the things that taxes pay for, including quality schools, safe communities, and being able to take care of the most vulnerable members of our society. It's time for a more balanced approach, and it's time to put taxes on the table. Minnesota cut taxes significantly during our surplus years, acting as if that boom economy would last forever. Our ongoing budget deficits prove that these tax reductions went too far. We think Minnesota can roll back a portion of these tax cuts to address the state's critical needs while still leaving our taxes lower today than they were in 1996. While certainly there are many revenue-raising options that this committee could consider, we think that making changes to the income tax is the best way to raise revenues while taking into account Minnesotans' ability to pay. And in this bill, the amount of additional tax that would be called for is reasonable, with an average increase of $242 when the changes are fully phased in. The recent tax incident study supports the need to pay attention to how we are raising revenues to ensure that the responsibility for funding government services is not falling disproportionately on low and middle-income Minnesotans. Now, some will argue that the state cannot raise taxes without causing dramatic harm to the economy, but the evidence does not support this. As shown in a paper by Peter Orszag of the Brookings Institution and Joseph Stiglitz, recipient of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Economics, both spending cuts and tax increases take money out of the state's economy. But while each $1 cut in government spending immediately removes a dollar from the economy, a $1 tax increase is likely to be offset by a partial reduction in savings. So, for example, that additional dollar in tax may be paid through a 90-cent reduction in consumption and a 10-cent reduction in savings. So a tax increase may be less of a drag on the state's economy than a spending cut of the same size. In addition, we saw in much of the 1990s, Minnesota had higher taxes than we do today and yet had stronger economic growth than our neighbors and the nation as a whole. A modest increase in taxes, like the one in this bill, an average $242 increase, can be made without damaging our economy. During the last several legislative sessions, the state has balanced the budget through a one-sided approach that has harmed Minnesota's families and communities. We ask you to take a different path this year and pass a balanced budget plan that includes the revenues needed to maintain our quality of life. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's all the speakers that we have.
Okay.
At this time, since we are fairly limited, we do have another presentation. I would just ask, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify in favor of House File 1516 or in opposition to House File 1516? Anyone else in the audience? Okay. If not, we have members' questions. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I want to thank Representative Paymar for having the guts to bring this bill forward. I agree with Representative Paymar that it's time to have this discussion. But I do want to thank Representative Krinke as well, who was willing to have this hearing and has been honest about taking all serious proposals seriously, and this is one. You know, listening to Bishop bulky. I'm Catholic, and my particular parish has been without a priest since June, and so we're trying to get a priest. And all Catholics know there's quite a shortage. But one of the benefits of not having a priest is we had Bishop, I believe his name is Pates, do our Easter Triduum services this last week. And so I'm not sure if it was during the homily of Veneration of the Cross on Good Friday or if it was during the actual Easter Mass. But that bishop spoke about raising taxes, and you could hear the church gasp. So I want to commend the religious leaders who are willing to take tough positions and are speaking to their groups now. So I know that takes some courage as well, so I thank you for doing that. I do want to say that, you know, I have a question about how this graph is laid out, but I know we get into the whole debate about taxes versus cuts. And I'm actually one person who thinks you could solve the budget deficit without a tax increase if you'd be willing to look at the whole budget and actually go back and look at what maybe we should stop doing. And I don't think either political party is willing to do that. I've never had a sense here that Democrats or Republicans want to seriously examine the $30 billion and majorly restructure it. So I think we're always debating the margins. You know, Democrats don't want to undo stuff, and Republicans don't want to add stuff. And I don't even think that's the debate. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think the Senate Democrats are right. And the chair knows that I have a bill that does the same thing the Senate is doing, is saying let's solve the deficit and then have a debate on if we should go further. And I hope we'll hear that this year. And I think that is a legitimate approach to justify everything we're doing. And if it takes taxes to do it, let's have them. And if we don't want to do everything, let's not have them. So I think Representative Tamar is right. It's time for us to have this debate, and if we're not willing to look at things in a hard, tough fashion, which I don't think we are, then we need to look at something like this. I think this is, as was stated by, I think, Mr. Leto, this isn't gimmicks, it's not one-time monies, and as someone who participated in that in the past, I don't feel guilty about those tax cuts I voted for. I feel guilty about the year we did all the shifts and the gimmicks, and this doesn't do them. This is a step in the right direction for being honest about it. But I was, to Representative Tamar, maybe it's to Ms. Manby in the graph, Representative Tamar, when you look at it, your proposal does show how if your bill passed, people would actually pay less in taxes than they did in 99. And I'm not understanding how that's possible when the top bracket's the same. Is that because the fiscal year and the tax year aren't matching up? Do you understand the question I'm asking, Ms. Manzi? I don't know why that top earner group would be actually paying less than.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynchewski, the other two rates both would be lower than what they were before the tax cuts, and all taxpayers get the first portion of their income in the first bracket. And prior to the 1999 tax rate reductions, those would have been taxed at 6%. Under the proposal, that first portion of income would be taxed at 5.7%. And then the second chunk of income would have been taxed at 8% in 1999 if rates had not been reduced that year. And under the proposal, that portion would be taxed at 7.62%, so there'd be a reduction on that chunk as well. And then the top chunk would be at the same rate, but those high income examples would always have the benefit of the continued reduction in the first two rates, so they would not see a net increase compared to what they were paying prior to the tax reductions in 1999.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up to Ms. Manzi, if I may.
Sure. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I understand that. So what Representative Tamar's amendment really does is says those first two groups aren't going to go back to the way it was in 99, but they're going to pay a little more than the current situation. Do you know if this legislature decided it isn't even going to come up with new money, but it's going to make the income tax system more progressive and actually bring that top decile up to pay its fair share, which we all know from the recent tax incident study this committee just reviewed, it's not paying its fair share. If we wanted just to do that, just to increase the progressivity, and we said let's stick with the current tax year for the first two brackets at 5.35 and 7.05, but we wanted to go to movement on the top bracket. Do you know how high that number would have to get to come up with the revenue that Representative Paymar is looking for? Representative Rukavina says, you know, the reason I'm asking is because I think that, you know, there is a debate in the legislature for those who want tax increases and don't, that, you know, how do you move these groups around? And I think what Representative Paymar has told me privately is he's trying to have a discussion here, and I think he's doing a good job of it. He's not locked into a particular way of doing it with what bracket. So I think it's worth knowing if we didn't want to take, you know, everybody who's in the first two brackets at all and give them a tax increase, what will we have to do to the top bracket to come to this kind of revenue level?
Mr. Chair, if I can, if I may.
Yes, Representative Paymar.
Well, I mean, for discussion purposes, Representative Lynchewski, I mean, if you took the companion bill, which is Senator Hottinger's bill, I think that does that, which is raising the top bracket to 8.7%. That I think does what you're suggesting. It raises about $860 million as opposed to the $1 billion. It's not a pure rollback in that respect, which is what my bill did or does. But again, this, if the tax committee and the legislature was serious about making adjustments or looking at the progressivity of the income tax, we can have that dialogue and debate. We were just trying to get some numbers out for you.
I have just one question, Ms. Madden. You, since you're still at the table, you referred to the proposal as a modest increase in income taxes. According to our February budget forecast, individual income taxes are projected. The collections are projected to increase the next biennium $2.6 billion, about 13.5% increase in income tax collections. This proposal on top of that would top something in over $3 billion increase in income taxes. So can you give us an idea what you would say was, if this is modest, what would you say is maybe more than modest?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I said that this is a modest increase because I think for any individual family, the increase is manageable. I would also mention that while our income taxes revenues are growing, much of that increased revenue is not available to deal with some of the demands on the state because, frankly, it's going to fill in some of the budget holes that were caused in the past. So I think if we were in a different situation where we are not coming off of a biennium where we used $1 billion out of the tobacco reserve, lots of other one-time money, the state would be able to use that revenue growth in different ways, but we are partly we're just using it to dig out of the budget hole we've created in the past.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vanderveer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just sorry that Bishop Balky left because I had some comments for him, but maybe I could talk to address this to Representative Paymar. You know, my mom spent much of her life as a single mother raising five children. She worked three jobs at times. She was a small business owner, and she always taught us to be generous in giving to people in need. But minutes after hearing Archbishop Flynn on the news earlier this year calling for what we heard today, she called me asking me what I was going to do about it, saying mainly she was, you know, quite upset with it. And again, she's a devout Catholic, and so she listens to what they say. But I had to explain to her that there wasn't much I could do about it, and that, you know, there's this little separation issue. But the use of taxes for charitable purposes was really vigorously debated in the early days of our government, as I'm sure you're aware, because it was considered easily corruptible. Was one of the arguments, and I think it was George Washington that said that government is not reason or eloquence, government is force. And to equate and kind of mix this, the charitable aspect of the function of government is kind of a difficult area, I think, to tread in, and I'm not sure it's really desirable. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Vandiver, I think that this maybe gets at, you know, some of the difference in philosophy between you and some members of your caucus and some members of our caucus about what the role of government should be. I mean, when I hear that because of the caps on dental care, that someone who's on Minnesota Care or GAMC, because of the caps that were put on, that people are actually going to the University of Minnesota and having their teeth extracted when they have regular dental problems because that's the only thing that's covered, I'm saying that there's something wrong when government is not, there's not a safety net that government puts out there to help the most poor and vulnerable in our state. And to me, that's been the mark of a progressive state that we've all known to, have been proud of, is that we do take care of those who are in need. And I'm not saying that we should be throwing money at every program that comes along, but I do think that we have a moral and ethical obligation to help families in need. And that's not to say that the faith community doesn't also have that obligation, and however else we choose to make our donations and help in our communities.
Thank you.
Members, we have the Minnesota Realtors here, and we'll have many opportunities to discuss this legislation or other legislation that increases taxes or reduces taxes at a later date. So thank you, Representative Paymar. Thank you to all of the witnesses that came forward.
Thank you.
At this time, the chair will lay over House File 1516 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I was just hoping that staff might be able to... I'm not sure that Representative Lachesky's question was answered. At least it spawned another question that I had. If we were going to just generate this amount of revenue by utilizing the top bracket, how high would we have to go? I'm curious, and we don't have to have an answer today, but if staff could maybe follow up, I'd be interested in knowing.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Manzi, you can help us with that and then distribute the information to members.
I don't have a problem with it. I like my idea better. I've got fine.
Ms. Manzi, we'll give you 2 minutes to answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Raising the amount of revenue in the bill as introduced with the rates proposed by Senator Hottinger simply by increasing the top rate would require the top rate to go to about 9.9%, and raising the amount of revenue raised under the Delete Everything amendment offered by Representative Tamar, I didn't bring that with me, but my guess is that it would require the top rate to go to around 10.2%, and I'll verify that and provide the information to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Manzi.
Thank you very much. Okay, we can move on. Mr. Dorman is here to give us a presentation from the Minnesota Realtors Association. Dorfman, I'm sorry. Mr. Dorfman.
Chairman, members, my name is Len Dorfman. I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and I'm happy to not do this if you want to take the other bill up, because this
we
is
can,
a presentation.
We'll take your presentation, Mr. Dorfman, and
appreciate that. Several things that we'd like to do if we could, and that is you all have in your packet something that looks like this, and there's another sheet with that. I'd just like to briefly go over what this study did, and frankly,
take 15 minutes out of this mayhem or 20 minutes out of this mayhem.
Mr. Dorfman, I'm sorry. Maybe since I didn't realize there are people here to testify on the other bill, so is it possible that you could come back and do this tomorrow?
I can absolutely do whatever the chairman wants.
Mr. Chair, come here anytime you want. He gets paid to be here. These other
he can't homestead here at the Capitol. He wouldn't live here.
But anyway. Mr. Chair, he's also always the highlight, I think, of the day.
Anyway, I apologize, Mr. Dorfman. As I said, I didn't realize this. We have other people here to testify on behalf of House File 1807. So thank you very much. We'll take up your presentation tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, I've appreciated this presentation by Dorfman today more than any other he's made.
Well, maybe tomorrow will be the true highlight. So, okay. Representative Nelson, the chair will move House File 1807 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you do have a House research summary on this bill in your packet, and along with some other information. I think it's important for everybody to remember that capital equipment actually already is exempt from tax. However, what the state has chosen to do is collect the sales tax on the equipment and then put the onus on the manufacturers to file for rebates. They also limit them to filing for those rebates no more than twice a year. What this amounts to is a state-mandated loan from the business community to the state with no interest paid. This reduces vital cash flow for a lot of our manufacturers, and in fact, over and above the money that they are loaning to the state of Minnesota, they are also having to pay interest on that when they go out and get a loan to purchase a large piece of equipment. I know that you're short on time, and we do have a number of testifiers, Mr. Chairman, but I do want to make a few points that what this state has always wanted to do is encourage businesses to invest and to grow their businesses. They grow their businesses and create more revenue for the state. They create more revenue in the form of new jobs and more jobs. And I think that's important because at all times, and especially in difficult times, by having to pay this sales tax up front and then hopefully request a rebate and then wait for the rebate to come from the state, it actually does a good job of stifling growth. While all manufacturers that pay the sales tax are eligible for the rebate, most of our businesses are small and medium-sized businesses. And the amount of work that they have to go through, the time to keep track of and then submit the paperwork, gets to be more than they can really afford. And so, in fact, we have a small percentage of businesses that even bother to ask for the rebate. Therefore, the state is the benefactor of a nice tax windfall, if you would. One of the other things, as I mentioned, the state of Minnesota, as all states are always trying to encourage more and more businesses here. We have a lot of programs, all states do. But I can give you an example just for my area in Chisago County. We're right across the border in the small city of Osceola, Wisconsin. 81% of the businesses that are in their industrial park were Minnesota businesses. 81% moved there. Wisconsin does not have this tax paid up front, nor does North Dakota. I don't know about the rest of you. I'm tired of listening to that guy from Sioux Falls on the radio trying to entice our businesses to come over there, too. And this is just another way that I think that we should go about correcting some of the inequities. In your packet, you should have a history of sales tax. And my dad was in the state senate in 1967 when the sales tax was enacted. And the state looked at that. The ones that came up with the idea said, this is a good way for the state to collect revenue without putting a lot of effort into it on the state's part. We have the retailers out there and the others collecting the money for us. What a great idea that was. As you follow that very brief timeline in your packet, we certainly could have gone several pages longer and given you more detail, but you'll see that our sales tax has morphed into something that is far from simple. And this has created a lot of problems in a lot of areas. Mr. Chairman, I will have other comments. We do have other people to testify, and I know we're pushing the clock. And so I would like to turn it over to some of my other testifiers here, if we could, sir.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting me appear today. My name is Mark Geyer, and I'm the volunteer lobbyist for the Minnesota Precision Manufacturing Association, and I also am a volunteer advocate for the Minnesota Manufacturing Coalition. The coalition represents about 25 manufacturing associations around the state. It is recently created just within the last year. This is the number one issue as far as legislative goals for the past 2 years for the manufacturers, the small and mid-sized manufacturers in the state. One of the items I'd like to point out in terms of how we got to where we are today, where we're paying a tax on tax-exempt equipment, is I think best summarized in that brief history. If you look at the material, you'll see that until 1984, capital equipment was subject to sales tax. Capital equipment is what it takes to manufacture products. It's what it takes to build wealth, hire people, and expand Minnesota's economic base. Until 1984, capital equipment was taxed along with everything else, but in that year, the state created a new sales tax exemption, and that was for qualified capital equipment. It was capital equipment that was purchased for a new manufacturing facility or for the expansion of an existing facility. At that point, it made sense to have the kind of statute we have today, a rebate program, because when a person paid sales tax on a piece of equipment, the state didn't know if it was for expansion or for something that was already in place. And so they created a rebate program. But beginning in 1994, this became antiquated. It made no sense anymore because in 1994, capital equipment was expanded to include not just new equipment for new facilities, but it was expanded to include any replacements and repairs to existing equipment as well. And you'll see that in 1994, the expansion took place. For years, manufacturers have been trying to get this law changed because for small manufacturers particularly, it has increased the cost to them, both of the equipment itself and also for getting the rebate back. Then we got the last, I guess you'd say, kick in 2003. You should see attached to that brief history a copy of the March 17th, 2004. This is last year's tax note on this particular bill, and you'll see that on the second page of that, it's actually, if you turn to the second sheet, second page, it tells what the state did in 2003. It basically balanced the budget on the backs of small businesses and small manufacturers and mining companies, and it did it by taking $50 million out of this program, this rebate program. This is money that had already been paid by the small manufacturers and the other manufacturers, took $50 million out of that program that was supposed to be rebated and put it into the general budget. That money now has been an ongoing issue because when I brought this up to the state as well as our legislators in the past 2 years, the question always is, where are you going to get the first $50 million to pay for your bill? The answer is it was money taken out of the pockets of the manufacturers. In order to lessen the impact of this bill in the first 2 years, we have a two-part proposal. First part is that a purchase exemption for the purchases of repairs to capital equipment, then beginning in July of 2007, it would be an overall exemption at the point of purchase for all capital equipment. At this time, I will turn over my the microphone to different speakers. The first will be Maureen Steinwall, president of Steinwall, Inc. in Coon Rapids. She has to catch an airplane, so she'll probably be leaving shortly after she speaks.
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Maureen Steinwall from Steinwall Incorporated. I own and operate a thermoplastic injection molding company in Coon Rapids. And I have about 100 employees, and we make about $10 million in revenues. Now, it's interesting, having listened to the raising of the tax bracket presentation earlier, if I could make more profits, you don't have to raise more brackets because I could contribute more taxes through the profit piece. And I can share with you, I'm about half of the profits I used to be 5 years ago, and it's not getting any easier. China and all the other competitive global issues are just eating at us. Anyone that steps foot in Walmart and loves those price slashes, that's at the root of the problem. We can innovate, but we can't continue to generate profits just in this price game that we're playing in the last 5 years. Having said that, I bring to you also another perspective. I'm a CPA by training. I also sit on the Monticello School Board, so I'm on your side of the game Monday night with how do we fund public education. And it all roots down to we have to create jobs, we have to create revenue. Our tax base is based in our revenue perspective and how we go about it. So I understand very clearly what the issue is. We would never have created this if we started with a clean sheet of paper. And I think that's what's important. If I were in your shoes, I would want someone to answer the question, why now? Why are we in front of you today? And there's about three things that have come together to cause the small manufacturers of the state of Minnesota to bring this issue forward. The first thing is Mark is a volunteer for us. This issue is rooted in it's just not right. It's just not fair. You're taking money and giving it back to us, but in the interim, you're using it in your cash systems. We manage by an accrual basis. The state manages by a cash basis. So let's take this loan free, get through the issues of the fiscal year, and then give it back to the business. So in essence, it doesn't hit our profitability, but it does help the state. Well, it's just not correct. We would have never set it up to be like this to begin with. But I brought with you, because I think this is what's important for you to see. This is my 1 year's tax return. We're not talking about a sheet of paper. We're talking about 40. This is just one tax return 1 year. So, no, it's not a handout. we're not talking about a simple piece of paper. We're talking about, I'm a CPA, so I do it for myself. It takes me about 40 hours a year to do so. Now, I also find it interesting because there's consultants that will call us and say to my peers who are not trained in the business gig, they're more the craftsmen of the world, the innovators of the world, the people we want to stay innovating. They say, tell you what, we'll dig through your file cabinets. We'll take 50% of anything that the state gives back. So the manufacturer only gets 50% of their money back. The state gets nothing, and its consultants get 50%. So maybe this is a good thing because we have a consultant employment gig going on here. I'm not quite sure. So it doesn't need to be. You know, if we just didn't collect the tax to begin with, we wouldn't have this kind of a process. And I know my peers behind you will all show that we in the hallway, who's this picker? I mean, they're all just huge. It's a huge problem. Well, the why now piece is because we are so globally hit with our competition of lean manufacturing as a philosophy that we are using very, very strongly to try to compete. And what that means is we are looking at every little place that we can find waste and get rid of it. And this is one of those places. It adds no value to the state of Minnesota. It adds no value to the manufacturers. It doesn't create jobs. It just is busy work. And it is a tremendous amount of drain on our resources. Also, I think the thing that brings me forward, because I've got a lot on my plate, is that, all right, so for the last 10 years, I'll fill out the paperwork. In the last 2 years, I have had 2 sales tax audits. I am a business that doesn't collect sales tax. Why am I getting audited? Now, I am not, and then the audit in and of itself took me about 4 weeks. So you're talking about another part of the state of Minnesota that is looking for revenue, and so they're out there auditing. Well, I file a $30,000 sales tax refund, and guess what? I get on their plate, I think. Now, two data points doesn't make a pattern, and I'm not at all to suggest that this is statistically beyond just random chance that I got audited. But you know what? That's, again, busy work. It didn't generate revenue. I am not the business that collects sales tax. So not only do I have to fill this out, but I'm on a radar screen because I'm asking for my money back. So you've got Mark that's helping us as small business who can't afford a lobbyist. You've got lean manufacturing going on where we're trying to find areas for waste reduction. And you've got the auditors thinking that this is a prime place to go find revenue. Those three forces are coming together, and it's causing us to have a tremendous amount of challenges. I think that's what I had. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking time from your business to come down and present today.
Next will be Mr. John Eagleton from North Star Aerospace in Duluth.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Tax Committee. My name is John Eagleton. I'm the CEO of North Star Aerospace in Duluth. In addition to that, I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Duluth Airport Authority, the Duluth Workforce Council, and the Arrowhead Manufacturers and Fabricators Association, which is a group of manufacturers in the Arrowhead of Minnesota that has 65 members strong. In addition, we have an educational trust as part of that association. Share with you today that I'm 65 years old next month. I've been in business in Minnesota over 40 years. This is the first opportunity that I've had to come to the state capitol. It's a serious issue. I drove from Duluth yesterday to share with you the burden that we face, and it's a particularly larger burden with companies that have experienced growth. We are a small manufacturing precision machining company, about $8 to $9 million in revenue, that has grown 1,100% in 8 years, over 300% the last 3 years, and we intend to grow this year 60%. So we are purchasing substantial amount of capital equipment to support the growth. 8 years ago, we had 6 employees. Today, we have 63, and that will continue. But when you're buying $1.5 million worth of equipment over the last 5 years, the sales tax amounted to almost $100,000. Now, to my business, when I'm growing and trying to support the growth, that's a lot of money that I share with the state of Minnesota temporarily. And the issue has become more burdensome some sense the refunds have been delayed. Years ago, we used to be able to get the refunds back fairly quickly. Now we wait 6 months or a year to apply for the refunds, and then there seems to be a built-in six-month delay on sending the money back after we've prepared the documentation for the rebate. This is the documentation for last year that I paid our CPA firm, to properly execute all of the forms correctly so that when it goes to the state of Minnesota, they don't find a little excuse on shelving it, rejecting it, sending items back that need clarification. It's a burden in the state of Minnesota for small business who are growing, and if we're going to continue to grow in Minnesota, we need to do something about having our cash flow back from the state. We're going to purchase this year and next year $600,000 in capital equipment. In addition to that, we'll be putting workers at that equipment. We run our company 4 days a week, 10 hours a day, two shifts. We now have a weekend shift, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, to utilize the equipment properly. We're a lean manufacturing company. We're challenged by all of our customers within the state of Minnesota and globally to get all of the waste out of our pricing to be competitive in the aerospace business. And this is part of the waste and part of the burden it is to do business in Minnesota. It is not across the bridge in Wisconsin. This burden is not across the high bridge from Duluth to Superior. We in Wisconsin, we don't pay the sales tax at the point of sale. So 40 years has taken me to say a few words. They're meaningful. I live with them day in and day out in my decisions to run my business, and it is, has been, and it is a continuing burdensome part of what I do. And I encourage you to support the bill. Get my cash flow back to me as quickly as you can.
Thank you, Mr. Eagleton, for coming down today, and also thank you for creating jobs in Minnesota.
We have one more witness, and that will be Mr. David Owen. And as he's coming down, I'd just like all members of the manufacturing community who are here in support of this bill to please stand. And if you've brought along your last rebate application, I'd like you to hold it up, because we have a number of people who came from all parts of the state this morning.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thanks for hearing us out today. My name is Dave Owen. I'm the president of the DHY Corporation in Lakeville. We have about 90 employees down there. We do almost all of our businesses out of state, so we bring money into Minnesota from outside the state, about $10 million a year. We've been in business for about 26 years, and I started actually in South Minneapolis in the basement of a house. So my brother and I own that company today, and what I'm holding in my hand is our part of the documentation for our refund application this year. This is about a $51,000 refund request. We, instead of receiving a refund, we've been notified that we're getting audited. So we're now preparing for that audit coming up here in the first part of April, and we'll have to see what comes of that. But I'm here also just to add my voice to the others to say this is really a non-value-added activity on the part of the state. It certainly does not add any value from our perspective. It doesn't do anything for us except consume time. It takes really vital capital out of circulation. A business like ours spends probably 30 or 40% of its sales dollars on raw materials. Contract services and labor are heavy elements of cost also. Those are all cash outlays that have to be made up front, in addition to the huge capital investments required in a precision manufacturing company. Last week, my brother and I sat down and signed on the dotted line again. We bought $1.6 million worth of capital equipment. And we're going to be manufacturing some fuel delivery components for environmentally improved outboard motors. So those blue streaks you see across the lakes are going to be getting reduced as we go to fuel-injected two-cycle engines. But the equipment required for that is very expensive. And with that kind of capital investment, we're going to have about $100,000 in sales tax that we're going to be paying. And we're not going to see that money for, who knows, 6 months, a year and a half. It's going to be a long time. That would be 4 months worth of bank payments on a purchase like that. We could pay two people for a full year with that kind of money. And instead, it's just being taken out of circulation. So it's really a penalty on things that I think the state, and I think we would all agree, the state would want to encourage people to go out and take risks to create jobs and bring economic vitality to our state. And instead of being encouraged, it feels like we're being penalized. And to be penalized for it hurts, but it's especially bad when it's not doing anything for anybody. It's not helping the state. It's just consuming your resources and consuming ours as well. We've also been notified that companies that we do business with outside of Minnesota have been audited. So we have received requests for sales tax payments due to companies out of Minnesota that we've purchased capital equipment from. Say a company in Michigan that needs to collect sales tax from us that said they didn't collect enough from us. Well, we're going to be sending a check to them, not knowing how long it will take, if ever, that money to come back to Minnesota. but then we'll be submitting a refund request anyway for that money. So it's just this crazy charade, this circle that goes around and around. So, well, thanks for hearing me.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll do a quick wrap-up here, if I might. And for the members that are still here, those employers, those manufacturers that you saw stand up a moment ago, in the last 15 months, they have invested about $12 million in purchasing capital equipment that they're going to pay that they've paid 6.5% sales tax on, and then apply for a rebate. We also have a person here that's representing the printing industry of the state of Minnesota, and it's 43,000 employees. Paul Holmberg spends 3 to 5% of his time just keeping track of this. And he recently, it took him 6 months and 6 phone calls to receive his $16,000 rebate. If you look at your revenue analysis, you'll also see that revenue has 2.5 FTEs just to handle getting this money in and then getting it back out to the people and doing the necessary audits. So you can see there's some savings on that side of it as well. Another company that couldn't be here that is from Alexandria, Minnesota. They recently purchased equipment that tied up $280,000 of their capital with state taxes. Again, as you just heard the testifiers, that's money that could be in circulation and jobs and such stuff as that. Members, we've come a long way since 1967 in sales tax, and we certainly aren't done with it. But I think that the time has come to realize that these interest-free loans have got to quit going on. As was explained to you, the bill that's before you allows the state of Minnesota to ramp up, if you would, for changing the system, with the first 2 years just addressing the repair parts for capital equipment, and then finally getting this thing where it belongs. And I think that we have to just realize that the current collection and rebate program really is a great, great injustice, and the state is collecting a tax that really isn't owed. That ends our presentation today, Mr. Chairman. We do have something for you from a number of the manufacturers, listing some of the equipment that they've purchased, and if you choose, you can distribute that to the members. Otherwise, we'll certainly stand for questions if you wish and if you have time, but we appreciate your moving this bill to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, did I misunderstand you? I'm sorry.
I don't think we're...
You know, as I get older, Chairman Krenke, my hearing gets less than perfect, you know, and it's good to correct me from time to time. Okay.
In the brief time remaining, thank you to everyone who took time out of their business to come here today. I guess what I'd like to ask is the Department of Revenue come forward and explain the revenue note. While these people are still here, we'd like to have them hear from the department as to how they work this process.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dick Gephardt. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm here to talk about the revenue estimate for House File 1807. Basically, this is the proposal that you've been discussing. It does go to an upfront exemption in two stages. The first is repair and replacement, which becomes effective on July 1 of 05. And then 2 years later, the remainder of capital equipment goes to an upfront exemption. The cost that you see here is basically the cost of unwinding the refund program and making it an upfront exemption. And again, just a brief recap, and you've heard this discussed, but the way the program works now is that purchase of capital equipment, the sales tax is paid, and then a firm does make application to the Department of Revenue. The way that works is firms can make two applications per year. and they can make them at any time of the year, but they also have 3.5 years in which to make those applications. So we have applications coming from all kinds of time periods here. But basically then, as you unwind this refund estimate from a refund program to an upfront exemption, you are in the first year paying partly refunds from prior periods, even though the program has ceased to exist. In other words, the first year of the program here, if you look in 06, we're basically saying that about $20 million of refunds are being paid on prior pay periods, and that you also are going to upfront exemption. So basically the revenue is going out in two phases. One is the upfront exemption is being incurred, and two is you're still paying out refunds from prior periods. Now, that payout of refunds from prior periods dissipates quite quickly over 3 years, and most of it occurs in the first year. But basically, that's the pattern. Because those two things overlap, you do incur a cost. And you can see that the cost does go down dramatically for repair and replacement parts. But then in 08, the second phase of this proposal kicks in, and that's about a $93 million cost. And so, again, that would dissipate over 3 years also. But basically, that's where the cost is coming from. It's coming from the overlap of unwinding a refund program while you're going to an upfront exemption.
Okay, Mr. Gephardt, before we get into some of the questions perhaps on these calculations, can you give me an indication as to why the department would conduct a sales tax audit for the company that doesn't pay sales tax?
Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm not really aware of the audit practices of the department to basically deal with the revenue estimation part of it.
Mr. Manson, you want to disappear on us somewhere? Yeah, don't hide for him. I was just can you give us? Okay. Someone else respond to that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Davison, and I work in the sales tax division with the Department of Revenue. I'm not an auditor, but I do work with policy, tax policy issues. And the reason a business would be audited if they're not collecting sales tax or not required to collect sales tax is that we're looking at the use tax issues. We're looking at their purchases to make sure that they have paid the Minnesota use tax. Examples of those purchases could be out-of-state purchases where they've ordered something in from out-of-state, not paid any tax on it because that seller is not required to collect Minnesota sales tax. In that case, they're required to pay the use tax to Minnesota. So that is a reason why they could be audited.
Could you get us specific information then on how much the department has collected from companies that are not collecting or are not required to pay sales tax, but then how much the department under those audits has actually collected in use tax?
I don't have that information with me.
No, I understand that. I'm asking if you could please go back and find that information and provide it to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I will go back and see what we can find for you. All right.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, on revenue.
Yes. Representative Lunchesky.
Thank you, Chairman Krinke. And just a question for Mr. Gephardt before he leaves on the revenue note. Looking at, I heard your explanation about phasing out the refund, but what part of the number here, because that 08 number is huge, what part of the number here is the people who currently aren't filing for the refund? Because I understand that there's a number of small businesses that don't even file because it's just too complicated, they don't know, and so they're currently not even getting what's due them. But what portion of this number is people who wouldn't be filing, so we're sort of counting their money that's really theirs as free money? And if it all goes away, I mean, some compliance number must be part of that $86
million. Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, that of that $86.9 in 08, we are estimating that about $76 million of it is the overlap, but there is an extra $11 million there that firms would get because of increased participation, because they are not participating in this program and filing for the refunds.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Gephardt, the department says that it's going out and auditing firms for sales tax compliance a good idea, but if someone who purchases capital equipment doesn't submit their refund form, that's okay. Is that the department's viewpoint?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think that's the department's viewpoint. This is an estimate of basically money that is not claimed under the current program, but when a firm is being audited and they are found that they did indeed qualify for capital equipment refund, that's pointed out to them. They're made aware of that.
So maybe we could ask for some information in those situations too, where audits have actually resulted in a situation where the firm gets money back in the context of they failed to apply for their. So let me go back. So if the firm failed to. If the business failed to submit their capital equipment refund claims, and it's within the 3.5-year period, and they are audited, then the department goes through and says and notes that those refund claims are can be filed, and then would use that as an offset against the. Any other tax owing? Or, I mean, I guess they can submit that. Is that correct? Is that what is being done at the department?
Mr. Chairman, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And the answer to your question is yes, and that's the problem with not having it as an upfront exemption. It's not very efficient. There's no way for the department to tell at the time of purchase that somebody's purchased something that's capital equipment or replacement parts and shouldn't have paid tax. Or should claim a refund. We can't notify them that, well, we understand you made a payment, unless we're on audit. And then as we're looking at the records, then we can say, that's capital equipment or replacement parts, and we notify them that that is exempt for capital equipment purchase. But because it's a backwards kind of process, we can't tell up front that they're making these payments and not getting the exemption they're entitled to. So much more efficient up front. To the intent of the law is to provide an exemption, and everybody should be entitled to the exemption, and everybody should take benefit of it.
Okay. Members, session has started, so I'm afraid we're going to have to leave members' questions another for a later time. The chairman will lay over House File 1807 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you again very much. I appreciate the business owners coming to present the issue. Meeting adjourned.